Made it up to handout 8. We're making progress. So while those new handouts are coming around, I'll remind us where we are on the overall course outline. We've made it through the historical summary up to the Maccabean period, and now we're at Roman numeral 5, which is developments in Judaism leading to the Maccabean period. So we've just covered the historical events leading up to this period and culminating in what's called the Antiochian persecution, which we covered last week with the events in Jerusalem and the persecutions that we read about from Maccabees. And that really sets the stage then for what is known as the Maccabean Revolt, which is a revolt against the rule and the persecution and the trying to eliminate the Jewish religion that was happening there in Jerusalem and in Judea. So we've kind of set the stage for that. But before we do that, I wanted to pause and kind of look at two developments that have been happening throughout this period up to this point. And those two things that we're going to take a look at are Hellenization, which we've mentioned a number of times, and then also we'll take a brief survey of what was happening in the Jewish priesthood at this time. So we'll take a look at those two subjects over maybe this week and part of the next week. Are there any questions or anything up to this point before we delve into this? Anything from last week or the persecution that we covered? Okay, so we've talked a lot about Hellenization already, and we'll take a step back here and remind ourselves what that is. So Hellenization comes from a Greek root, hellas, which basically means Greece. And when we take that and turn it into Hellenization, that is the influence of Greek culture on the world, but specifically on the Eastern nations, Asia Minor, and then moving to the East and even into Persia. So that's what Hellenization means. It's making things Greek, basically. And there were a number of factors in the spread of Greek culture. Up to this time, there have been Greek influences already on the world. The Greek philosophy had happened even going back centuries before. And there had been some earlier Greek influences on the Middle East and the East. But really that it was significantly expanded during the time of Alexander the Great and his conquests. We studied a little bit about Alexander and his personality and his zeal. He had a specific agenda. One of his goals was to not just conquer, but to conquer and bring the Greek culture wherever he went, because he was a firm believer that that was a superior way of life. His personality had a lot to do with it too. We noted that a lot of people willingly embraced what he was bringing to them. A lot of the cities opened their gates and welcomed him. And then during that conquest and afterwards, during the period of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, which we just covered, a number of Greek cities were established. So this was another way that Hellenization was happening in the area. There were existing cities that were Hellenized so that they came into an existing city and the people embraced it. And there were things like new buildings, new Greek buildings and things like that built. But there were also brand new Greek cities that were established. And this is where you've heard the term polis. That's a Greek city-state. And so new Greek cities called polis, a polis, were planted. And often those were colonized with retired soldiers. That was a common way of Hellenizing, you know, of establishing a certain culture. That's not new to the Greeks, but we also see that with other cultures and in the Romans. But it was often retired soldiers were looking for some place to go live after their service, and they would colonize these new Greek cities with them. And then these Greek retired soldiers would intermarry with the population that was there, the local population, and you start to get the Greek influence that way. One example of this in the Bible from the New Testament is the Decapolis. You remember reading about that. But in Matthew and in Mark, the Decapolis is mentioned, which was 10 cities, Deca, Polis. So it was a group of 10 cities. And so that's an example of how Greek cities were established in the area. So that was one of the influences, new cities. Another influence was just the appeal of Greek culture. The Greek culture was very appealing to a lot of people. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The architecture, for example. The Greeks were known for building very fine buildings. They built amphitheaters, stadiums, basically a new architecture that was very appealing to people. And then we have the whole Greek learning. Education was a big thing in Greece. You all know that the philosophers sort of originated in Greece, and we've got the great schools of philosophy that came out of there. We read about some of that in the New Testament. When Paul was in Athens, he's dealing with Epicureans and Stoics, or some of the later philosophies that came out of Greece. But they were known for thinking and spreading their ideas. You know, Luke in Acts even says that they didn't do anything in Athens other than just talk about the latest ideas. So sort of a negative connotation there, but that gives you insight into their interest in philosophy. Literature. We all know about Greek literature, and many of us have read them, some of the Greek literature, some of the great epics, as well as plays and things like that. Athletics was another thing that they were known for. You know, we take athletics for granted in our day and age, and sometimes we're consumed by athletics, either watching on television or doing things with our kids. But at the time, athletics was a new thing to the East. In some ways, that's even true to some extent today. You very seldom see Eastern countries like in the Olympics, for instance, if you ever notice that. Bringing of athletics into the East by the Greeks was a very new thing to them. And then politically, the Greeks were known for democracy, where everyone is able to discuss ideas and even be involved in politics, which, again, was a new thing when you come to the East, which is ruled primarily by monarchs. So the Greek idea of democracy was a new thing. So all of these things had an appeal to the people there in the Middle East, in the Near East, in the Far East. The cultivation of the physical body, so we mentioned athletics, but the Greeks were very interested in the natural physical body. And we'll see some of the impacts of that later. But that was another thing that kind of goes along with athletics in a way. And so many of the people in the Middle East embraced Hellenism as a superior way of life because of all these new changes, which many people saw as a better way of living, of having a culture built around that. Now, the other thing is that Palestine was nearly surrounded, if you think about where Palestine is located, it was nearly surrounded by significant Greek influences at this time. We've already talked about how the Egyptians were coming up from the south, the Syrians were coming down from the north, and Palestine was sort of the intersection of that. Well, remember, both of those were heavily Greek influenced at that time, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Although they were based in Egypt and Syria respectively, they were really Greek in culture. So we've got, you know, in Alexandria, remember Alexandria was established in Egypt, and that was really the cultural center of the Mediterranean at that point in time. And it was a completely Hellenized city. The Syrian base was in Antioch, and we know about Antioch again from the New Testament, because that's one of the home bases of the missionary journeys of Paul and Barnabas, but that's up to the north of Palestine. That was the capital of the Syrian Empire, and it was a Greek city. The other influence was all along the coast, the coastal cities in what is today Israel and Lebanon. Most of those cities were all Greek as well. All the port cities, if you will, had a strong Greek influence. So all of that is all around Palestine. So not only that, but their rulers, their overlords, as we've just been discussing over the last couple weeks, had Hellenizing agendas, some more compulsory, some more voluntary. But either way, there was pressure to conform to the desires of the people who are ruling over you. So there's the, sort of that, a little bit of political pressure that way too, to appease your overlords. So all of these things were the factors in the spread of Greek culture into Judea. Yes, Pastor. Yeah, that's a very good point. That the point was, just to repeat for the tape, that the Greek influences seen here in the early American fathers, as well as, you know, the architecture that we see in some of the great buildings. So it's had a strong influence on our country as well. So what did this do to Palestine? Well, it brought some fairly dramatic changes, because Palestine was really an Eastern way of life. So this sweeping Greek influence had a number of influences and changes to Palestine. One of them was in politics. So we mentioned the Greek polis, where the principles of free citizenship were established. So that was a change in the cities that were in Palestine that were Hellenized. And then we've talked about architecture. So architecture was one of the big influences that we see in Palestine. Big building programs, new amphitheaters and stadiums, as we said, and we'll see how that continued all the way into the New Testament era. Greek dress is another influence. People began, and you read this in, like, Josephus talks about this, and it's even hinted at in the Maccabees, that people began dressing, changing their style, if you will, to dress like Greeks, because they wanted to be Greek. They wanted to be known as Greeks. And then, of course, we have the Greek language, which we'll talk more about later, because that had a very significant effect, really, on the world. But Greek really became the universal language of that whole area of the world. And, of course, we know that the Old Testament was translated into Greek at this point in time, which is the Septuagint, which was most likely the version of the Old Testament that the apostles and Jesus used. So that had a very significant influence in that way. Physical exercise. I mentioned that that was kind of a new thing to the Eastern cultures, and the emphasis on the body. And so the way that that came into Palestine was gymnasiums were built. And we already talked about that before, that Jason, the Hellenizing high priest, if you remember from last week, he built a gymnasium. One of the first things that he did was built a gymnasium in Jerusalem. Stadiums, athletic contests. Another thing that maybe I haven't mentioned yet is public baths. That was also a new thing, public baths where everyone was basically naked in the baths. And that's, again, the emphasis on the body and maybe the loss of the mores, where you're not supposed to show your naked body to people. And that was something that came along with the Greek culture. I've got a quote here on the gymnasiums from this man, Edwin Bevan. And he says that gymnasiums expressed fundamental tendencies of the Greek mind, its craving for harmonious beauty of form, its delight in the body, its unabashed frankness with regard to everything natural. So that kind of sums up what I was just trying to say about the body. The next section here we'll get to what kind of challenges that presents to the Jews of the day. But before we do that, the one last thing I have here in terms of influence is more along the lines of the literature and the arts. So philosophy, literature, arts and education. How did that impact Judea? Well, theaters were built, and so then now Greek plays began to be performed in the theaters. So that's an art. Schools were established for training of youth. There's a term for this, ephebion, which means youth center, was a place where youths were educated and trained in Greek culture. And we mentioned last week that the gymnasia was part of that as well. We talked about this last week, but when we think about a gymnasium, we think about a place where we play basketball. And a gymnasia was actually a Greek educational institution back then. So it was focused around physical training, but it was really training in the Greek way of life, which is one of the reasons why that was one of the first things that a Hellenizing priest would want to do, is build a gymnasium. He's not building it just for athletics and for physical training, but he's building it because it's a way of training youth in Greek culture. And that, by the way, is why the Syrian ruler at the time, I forget which one it was, well, it was Antiochus IV, I guess, but why he was interested in having Jason do that, because it's a way of bringing Greek culture, and a way of changing the culture, really, of Judea to be more sympathetic to his ideas. And so we've got gymnasia being built in right in Jerusalem at this point in time. So, you know, just a brief outline of some of the changes. Now, what kind of challenges does this present? And here we can maybe be thinking about how this parallels some of the challenges that we face in our culture today. And we can talk about that when we get to the end of this section. So maybe keep that in your mind. Yes, Dave, that's a good point. The point is that we're basically talking about leisure time almost, and the fact that there must have been an influx of wealth to make that happen. And I'm not quite sure how that worked. I know that the buildings, the programs, the building programs were 100% paid for by the government, right? Because that was what they were doing, which ultimately came from taxes, of course, from the people. So the people were paying for it too, but also spoils of war and things like that were funding that. And I don't know if there were incentives for the people to put their children in these programs, you know, to send them to the gymnasium or to the Ephesian. I'm not sure about that. That's a good point. Somebody who's, like you said, eking out a living by farming or whatnot, you wouldn't think that they'd have a lot of time to be going off to these other pursuits. So what were some of the specifically religious challenges that come along with all this cultural change? Well, one obvious one is syncretism. So those of you who are familiar with the Greek pantheon, all of the Greek gods, that's kind of natural right to the Greek way of life is the Greek pantheon. But there's also elements of Eastern religions in here too, because there was a lot of mixture at this point in time, particularly in Palestine. Remember, it had been ruled for centuries by the Persians, which are more like the Zoroastrianism. Think of the wise men, the magi that came from the East and things like that. So there was a lot of syncretism here. Greek religion was intimately intertwined with political and civil life at this time. Basically, another way to say that is worshiping the gods was just part of being a good citizen. If you were a good citizen, you worshiped the gods as part of what you did. Athletic games, for example, were opened with sacrifices. The religious aspect of it was completely intertwined with daily life, political and civil life. And you can imagine then what kind of huge challenges that would present to a monotheistic Jew who's now dealing with this syncretistic view that's sort of taking over their culture. And again, you can think about parallels to the world we live in today along those lines. But another challenge was the immorality associated with the pagan gods and the rites. There was a lot of immorality associated with that. There was nudity. I mentioned nudity already, but nudity in athletics. The athletic competitions were typically carried out in the nude. The public baths is another example where nudity was just part of the Greek culture. A lot of that had immoral connotations as well. Some of you maybe have read some of Plato, and there's sections, I forget which of the works it is at this time, but there's a lot of, you can read some of the immorality that was associated with just part of being part of Greek life at that time. It's right there in Plato. So that was a significant challenge to the Jews of the day. Circumcision then comes to the forefront there. So all of the Jewish males had been circumcised, and now they were trying to compete in athletic events which exposed their circumcision. And that caused shame to a lot of the people who wanted to participate in these. And so in Maccabees, it actually talks about there was a surgical procedure that they were reversing their circumcision. I don't know how that worked, but you can see the amount of pressure that they were under because of this emphasis on the body, where the body was exposed. You know, when you think about the religious connotations of reversing their circumcision, which was the mark of the covenant, you can think about, you know, how serious that was. And then, just progressive religion. So that's something that is alive and well in our day today. the Jewish monotheistic exclusivist viewpoint was viewed as archaic, and it needs to be updated to be consistent with the Greek worldview. And really, we can sum a lot of these influences up by one term, secularization. The culture was moving towards secularizations as opposed to the Jewish culture, which was a theistic state. So now we've got all these secular influences coming in that are moving it away from a theistic state where God is the center, you know, the temple is the center, and God, the worship of the one true God, is the center. Enormous cultural challenges were faced here by the Jews. And we might ask then, how did the Jews respond? Well, I've highlighted sort of three different general responses here. And the first is what's called the Hellenizing party. These are people that embraced the change. They embraced Hellenism, and they wanted to move more towards the culture of their Greek neighbors, and they saw that as a superior way of life. And I read this passage before, but I'll just read it again. So these people are described in 1 Maccabees. Now remember, the writer of 1 Maccabees is not sympathetic to the Hellenizers. And this is what 1 Maccabees says about these folks. At that time, there emerged in Israel a group of renegade Jews who invade many by saying, "We should go and make an agreement with the Gentiles round about. Nothing but disaster has been our lot since we cut ourselves off from them." This proposal was widely approved, and some of the people, in their enthusiasm, went to the king and received authority to introduce pagan laws and customs. They built a gymnasium in the Gentile style at Jerusalem. They removed their marks of circumcision and repudiated the Holy Covenant. They intermarried with Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. So that's a description of those people who would have embraced Hellenism sort of lock, stock, and barrel. Another lesser embracing of Hellenism would have been a middle view, which I'm calling a synthesis, where people would combine the Hellenistic ideas with their Jewish religion. So they're not going fully to the Hellenistic way, religious and everything, but they're saying, there's a way for me to combine these Hellenistic ideas, these Greek ideas, with my religion. So they would be trying to retain the Jewish religion, but introducing elements of Greek philosophy, for example, modifying Judaism to be compatible with Greek thinking, like some of the, you know, the philosophical schools like Platonism, Stoicism, or Epicureanism, modifying that. And a good example of this is a famous historian by the name of Philo. He was an Alexandrian Jew who wrote a lot of things, history as well as philosophical writings. And I think he wrote commentaries. He wrote about scripture as well. But he's a good example because he was very influential. Like I mentioned, he was in Alexandria. He considered himself an Orthodox Jew. Yet he brought in many of the Greek ideas. And the way that that influenced him is he began to interpret the Old Testament allegorically, particularly where he wanted the Old Testament to conform more to Greek ways of thinking, or maybe to eliminate problematic areas in the Old Testament, problematic historical events. So that was an allegorical interpretation of the Old Testament. Probably almost no one in this room has ever read Philo, but that had a significant advantage down through the ages because, if you remember, Alexandria was also a center for the early church. So some of our early church fathers came from Alexandria, like Clement of Alexandria and Origen, who is maybe a more famous church father. And so Origen is known for adopting the allegorical method of interpretation of scripture. And that became a hallmark of the Alexandrian school. And so it's come into the Christian church through that influence. And believe it or not, there's probably still repercussions of that all the way down to our day. with the way people interpret Scripture. So that would be more the synthesis approach, where people are not repudiating their Judaism, but they're bringing in these Greek ideas to try to mix them together. And then the final approach I've listed here is, I'm just calling it the Orthodox response. So there was a group of people that resisted Hellenization and defended Jewish tradition and religion. These are referred to as the Hasidim, which means the pious ones, loosely translated, pious ones. So they were people who were basically not giving in at all to the Greek influences. It's likely that this group of people were some of the ones who were at the forefront of the massacres during the Antiochian persecution, because they were likely the ones that were resisting. They were the ones that were going ahead and circumcising their children. They were still hiding and reading the law. They weren't delivering their scriptures over to be burned, and they were resisting. It's probably likely that this group of people in general bore the brunt of the persecution. Many of this group then would have had sympathy with the Maccabean Revolt. I realize we haven't talked about the Maccabean Revolt yet, but that's the next big thing that's going to happen. It was an armed revolt. And so many of this group would have had sympathy with that armed revolt and gave support to the resistance movement, at least for the early years of it. And although we don't have any authoritative biblical account of what was happening with the remnant of God's people, that is the faithful remnant during this period, we might speculate that they were most likely in this group of the pious ones, the Hasidim. So the people that we see at the beginning of the New Testament, who were, you know, looking for the kingdom to come, looking for their deliverance, the deliverance of Jerusalem, would have likely been sympathetic, if not part of this Hasidim movement. And so that's kind of a summary of what was happening culturally with this sort of forced and voluntary Hellenization of the culture. And I guess at this point I'll just open it up for further questions about what was going on, and maybe we can even get into a little, it's pretty obvious that there's parallels here to our culture today, so we might want to spend a few moments drawing some of those implications out for us today. Yes, Carl? Yes. The question is, in the opening pages of the New Testament, we read about Herod and other people who were in rule at the time, and Herod would be considered a Hellenizer, right? Although a very savvy Hellenizer. Very savvy, trying to appease everyone, right? Trying to appease the Romans, trying to embrace Greek ways of life, but also trying to appease the Jews. So he was a synthesizer. Yeah. He was a master synthesizer, actually. So yeah, but generally the rulers were Hellenized at that point in time. Yeah. So what parallels do we see here with the temptations that the Jews were facing to the temptations that we face today in our culture? How about cultural accommodation? We all want to be good members of our culture, but at what point do we make decisions and draw lines? Maybe it's obvious. Some of the things are obvious that we face in our culture. Like, for instance, we might not be tempted to accommodate ourselves to the immorality of our culture. That's kind of a clear black and white thing that we can recognize, and we can recognize that we need to take a stand against that. Maybe another one of the more subtle dangers is kind of what happened with the synthesizers here, right? How might we be tempted, or how might the church be tempted to compromise with the culture, to be more appealing to the culture, for instance? And perhaps that's one of the more dangerous aspects to it, where you think you're just going a little bit over to be more appealing to the culture, but you're actually taking the first step towards an accommodation to the culture where you really should not be accommodating in that point. Yes, Ron? The comment was borrowing Francis Schaeffer's observation that change, in this case, change for the worse, typically starts in the academia and then it works its way down. I forget all the steps, but it it works its way down through the culture, and then the last place it changes is in the church. And that's something that, I mean, I think is very insightful and true. To put it in our context, it would be at the seminary level where it would first run up against the church. And that's why our seminaries are so important. And we've seen battles over the past couple decades regarding the authority of Scripture. And the seminaries are always on the forefront of that battle in terms of the church fighting that. Well, we'll wrap up on that note. And next week, we'll take a look at what was happening with the priesthood during this period of time. And then that'll lead us up to getting back into the history of the Maccabean Revolt.